Allow me to introduce Dr. Hobel Karsten Brueggemann, an esteemed scholar and professor. Here's an overview of his impressive background. He was born on December 1, 1965, in Hamburg, Germany. As far as his educational credentials are concerned, he received his MA in History and Slavic Philology in 1993 from the University of Hamburg. He received his Doctor of Philosophy in 1999, also from the University of Hamburg, the History Department. He earned the prestigious Dr. Hobel in 2013 from the University of Gießen, Germany, the History Department, which is the highest academic degree in Germany. And as far as his professional credentials are concerned, he began his career as a research assistant at the Department of Education Science Institute for History at the University of the Federal Armed Forces, Hamburg, from January 1994 to March 1998. He was a contract lecturer in Baltic Studies at the Institute for Finno-Ugric Studies, University of Hamburg, from 1996 to 2002. He was a contract lecturer of Eastern European History at the History Department, University of Hamburg, from 1999 to 2001. He was a research assistant at the archive of the Institut Nordost Deutsches Kulturwerk, Lüneburg, Germany, from April 1998 to December 2001. He was a visiting lecturer in history and German studies at Narva College of Tartu University from September 2002 to August 2004. He was elected docent for general history at Narva College of Tartu University, where he also served as head of the humanities department. He was a research assistant at Nordost Institute Lüneburg, Germany, from September 2005 to August 2008. And finally, professor of Estonian and general history at Tallinn University, Institute for History, since September 2008. Karsten Brueggemann's expertise spans the history of the Baltic states and Russia, cultural history, transnational history, and the historical dimension of sports, tourism, and music. He is a distinguished academic whose contributions have enriched our understanding of these fields. Tere, and welcome to History of Estonia podcast, Professor Brueggemann.
Hello. Hello, William.
Let's begin. The Great Northern War, which went from the years 1700 to 1721, marked the end of the good old Swedish era in Estonia, and it marked a new Russian era that would last until Estonian independence on February 24th, 1918. What was the impact of the Russian Empire's annexation of Livonia and Courland in the 18th century on the region's political and economic landscape?
Yeah, I mean, the impact was of course quite important, at least on the surface. But if you go into the details, you might argue that there was not such a huge difference for the ordinary citizens, you know, ordinary peasants, because the social structure didn't change a bit. It was slavery, and it remained slavery under Russian rule. And I mean, we use the term annexation, and that's not completely wrong. But on the other hand, we have to take into account that it was the regional elites, the Baltic Germans, who basically agreed to be from now on under Russian rule. And in order they didn't want to have any kind of big changes. They wanted to retain their power situation, their power position in the country, in the Baltic provinces. And they managed to get all these things they wanted guaranteed by Peter the Great. So, for instance, in religious questions, right? I mean, Baltic German elites, they were given the right, the privilege to stay Lutherans, which was quite important, to use the German language, and all these things were being guaranteed by Peter the Great. And so the nobilities of Estonia, of Estland province, and of Livland province, they simply concluded so-called capitulations. And in the capitulations, in the text of these capitulations, all these privileges were being granted by Peter the Great. So from that point of view, from the point of view of power structures, basically nothing changed that dramatically because the Baltic Germans kept their position and Petersburg basically left the provinces alone.
Okay, thank you. There was a close relationship between the Baltic German noble representatives and the empire's rulers. How did this relationship develop during the 19th century?
This relationship, in a way, it started with these capitulations, right? From that time onwards, the Baltic German nobility, at least those who stayed in the country, they kept basically loyal to the Romanovs, basically, until the end of the empire. And there were quite a number of Baltic German nobles who then changed into the service of Peter the Great, people who just went to Russia proper. Some of them took even Orthodoxy. And so they became a member of this imperial elite of the Russian Empire. And this was the basis for the quite good relations between the Russian rulers, the Russian dynasty, and the Baltic Germans. They were part of this European alliance of aristocracies, which was quite typical for the time, right? I mean, nationality, ethnicity, that didn't count at that time so much. And so it was basically the social status of people that determined on which position they could serve their empire. And why not serve the Russian Empire? So for the Baltic Germans, this was a kind of win-win situation.
What role did Estonians play in the Russian perception of the region? And what can you say about the period of so-called Russification?
I mean, these are two very, very delicate questions in a way, and I might start with the first one. From the Russian perspective, from the Russian point of view, the Baltic provinces, which included from 1795 as well, Courland, they were seen basically as European parts, as the German provinces of the Russian Empire. And I mean, people at that time, they in the early 19th century, people just started to travel on their own and not in anybody's service. And so first reports about how these provinces looked like to reach the educated public in Russia just in the first half of the 19th century. And when you go through all these descriptions of these Gothic towns, these fascinating stories of medieval chivalry and things like that, you really get the impression that in the Russian elite's impression of the early 19th century, they created their own kind of Russian medieval way of life with all the things that people knew at that time from the novels of Walter Scott. So it was about tournaments between knights and things like that. It was the conflict between urban dwellers and the nobility, and all these things we know from Western European literature, was being inscribed into this territory on the shores of the Baltic Sea, which by chance happened to be a part of the Russian Empire. So, this landscape and the provinces, in a way, they were used to create a very European image of the Russian Empire. And we have it even in written sources that. For the dynasty at that time and for the ruling elites in Russia, it was precisely the possession of the Baltic provinces that made the Russian Empire European.
Okay,
And
thank you.
Russification, I mean, this is, of course, a story that is pretty much this is pretty much part of this national narrative, especially of Estonians and Latvians and also of Baltic Germans. Because the relationship between the Russian center, the imperial center in Petersburg, and the Baltic German nobility, it changed quite dramatically during the second half of the 19th century because of nationalism. Nationalism was something that the imperial elites in Russia at that time had to fear because they knew quite perfectly well that The Russian Empire was a multinational empire. So what happens if every single ethnic group in the empire would would start to become nationalistic, right? I mean,
Trouble, yeah.
you could imagine that this would be the end of the empire. But on the other hand, there were quite a lot of members of this imperial elite themselves who started to believe that nationalism might be a good ideology also for the empire. They saw the story of Italian Risorgimento, of reunification, unification of Germany, and all seemed to be powered by nationalism. And so, why not use nationalism to keep the whole empire closer together? I mean, this is a problem that is not solved until nowadays, right? Is
Right.
Russia a national state or is it an empire? And can Russian nationalists can they be, is it enough for them to be just a national state? Or would they need to have some kind of imperial outstretch to other regions, right? So this is not solved. And in the late 19th century, under Alexander III, Russian internal politics became to be impacted by nationalism and by nationalist ideas to make the non-Russian peripheries more Russian. This was one of the slogans of the time. And even if the term Russification has been used predominantly by Baltic Germans, Estonians, Latvians, as part of their victim narrative, right? I mean, we were subject to Russification and everything changed dramatically. From the Russian point of view, it looks completely differently. It's nothing aggressive. It's meant as a kind of defensive strategy to keep the empire together. And so these two narratives, in a way, they clashed to such an extent that even nowadays in school books in Estonia and Latvia, you would find the term as a term that describes a whole period. On the other hand, and that's my last point, even Estonian historians nowadays accept that things like introducing Russian language into the school curricula, I mean, this made it perfectly possible for Estonians, for former peasants, to move into the empire, right? To migrate into the empire and
Right.
to make some social careers because they managed to talk and to speak in Russian. So they learned the imperial language, the lingua franca of the empire. And this was a huge benefit. And this is, until nowadays, it's a debate, right? I mean, was this period of let's say unifying and modernizing the empire, centralizing the empire, was this a story of success or was it a failure, right? Russian nationalists would always argue that no, it was a complete failure because until the end of the empire, we have German language and we have Protestant religion in the Baltic states, in the Baltic provinces. So where's Russification, right?
How did the Russian Revolution of 1917 affect the Baltic littoral?
This is also a very big question. And I mean, we have to imagine ourselves how the map of the Baltic borderlands of the empire looked like in result of the First World War. The Germans had occupied the whole Lithuanian region, and they had occupied half of Latvia at that time. So the Russian Revolution, in fact, could have an impact only on Estonia. And it had a tremendous effect on Estonia, which hitherto has not been really assessed by historiography so well, because from the Estonian national point of view, the most important event of that period was the War of Independence. And so everything that was before this War of Independence from 1918 to 1920, this is somehow in the shadow of this really important event. But in spring 1917, when we look into newspapers and into memoirs that would tell about the time, you would find the same revolutionary enthusiasm in among the Estonians as in other urban areas of the empire at that time. So people were happy that once and for all, Nikolai II was gone. And now maybe there come more democratic times. And for Estonians, this meant at that time, we hope for autonomy, right? And if this process is going to be continued before the Bolshevik coup d'etat in October 1970, there were really hopes that we can have a kind of cooperation with the Russian liberals and we have an autonomous Estonia later on. And in fact, for Estonia, this worked quite nicely out because in late March, the provisional government in St. Petersburg would grant the Estonians this kind of national autonomy for the first time in their history. So we have an Estonian at the top of the province from spring 1917. And this is basically the most important development during that revolutionary period.
That makes sense, yes. To what extent were the Baltic states involved in the Russian Civil War?
They fought in a way for their existence against the Red Army, basically. Because it's always very difficult with terms. If we talk about the Russian Civil War, we tend to forget that on the borderlands, we have quite a number of local forces that would fight against the Red Army, right? The Red
Sure.
Army wanted to recover the former empire and to march into the heart of Europe in order to spread the revolution. And the local military forces wanted to pretend that. And for the Baltic states, this was really a time of existential battles. Whereas in Western Europe, people would celebrate the end of the First World War, the war in the Eastern European territories only started. And so the fight against the Red Army was one of the major events and the major battles of these wars of independence. But in the end, and that's the paradoxical thing, we have also to think about the white Russians, the anti-Bolshevik Russians, who partly fought together in coalitions with the new nationalist regimes. And I have written my PhD just about one of these white Russian generals, Nikolai Yudenich, who wanted to conquer the old imperial capital, Petersburg, Petrograd at that time.
Okay.
And he needed, of course, cooperation. He needed a basis for his troops, and he found it in Estonia. But the Estonians, right from the start, were very well aware that Yudenich was not an ardent supporter of national democracy. So he wanted to bring the empire. So this was a very complicated net of contacts, of allegiances, and things like that. And in the end, it played out quite the opposite of what Yudenich wanted. His own troops in late 1990s were used by the Estonians in order to defend the national borders of Estonia against the Red Army. And this was, of course, the failure of the white movement in that region.
Fantastic. How did the Soviet Union perceive the small countries on its western border, and how did this perception change in 1939 to 1940?
That's also an interesting topic, and I've made some research about that because we all know that in the Russian mainstream media until 1917, we have this classical legitimation of Russian rule on the littoral with arguments like this has been a historical Russian territory, even before the Germans came in the 13th century. And they would rely on chronicle information that the city of Tartu was being founded by Yaroslav the Wise in the 11th century and things like that. And these arguments, in a way, they can be found also in early Soviet books and brochures about the new neighbors in the East. These books would argue that this kind of independence can only be a temporary phenomenon, because historically, culturally, and of course economically, these states cannot exist without a dense network with Russia. And of course, this was the opinion in the West of Europe at that time as well. Nobody could think about the existence of these small states with just 1 million of inhabitants. How can you survive, right? So this is basically the same argumentation on both sides of the upcoming conflict, East and West. And of course, what changed in the Soviet perception was this kind of constructing an enemy. Because the enemies in the Russian period were nationalists, right? Estonian nationalists, German nationalists. But for the Soviet perspective, the most important argument against the independence was that they were just dependent on the capitalist and imperialist powers, meaning Great Britain, United States, France, Germany, and so on. So they tended to use an social argumentation instead of the ethnic argumentation that was used in the Russian Empire. And all of a sudden, at the time when Russia, when the Soviet Union in 1940, 1941 again recovers or reoccupies the Baltic littoral, the argumentation starts to change again, because they would then again use these ethnic kind of arguments. And Stalin is reported to have said after the annexation in 1940 that the Baltic region that used to be part of Russia is again part of Russia. So he was himself quite well aware of this kind of argumentation, and he used it. So we have this so short period of time when the argumentation was somehow adapted to ideological demands. They used a social argumentation, but later, from 1940 onwards, it was again the old way of ethnic stereotypes that were used in order to legitimate that Soviet Union was taking over the Baltic countries.
Thank you. What was the role of the Baltic SSR in the larger framework of the USSR?
How can you, this is again a question that you cannot really answer with just one sentence. Initially, and this is something that is being stressed also nowadays in Russian historiography, the meaning was first and foremost strategic. Because everybody knew that sooner or later there will be this conflict with Nazi Germany. The Russians just needed better strategic positions to defend, for instance, Leningrad at that time. Again, a very similar argument to what was used also in the Tsarist period, the Baltic provinces at that time, as a kind of defense zone for capital, for Petrograd, for Petersburg. Later on, after the Second World War was won, this perception of the Baltic SSRs again changed. And you would have a very important way of thinking in the Soviet leadership that we might use these developed countries, these kind of, again, Europeanized countries, as a kind of shop window for socialism. So from the mid-50s onwards, we would have, and even from the mid-40s sometimes, we would have invitations to first foreign communists, later to foreign tourists in general, to visit exactly the Baltic provinces, the Baltic SSRs at that time, in order to make kind of PR campaign for the benefits of socialism. I mean, if you compare the Baltic SSRs with Ukrainian, Belarusian cityscapes in the 40s and 50s, where basically nothing was intact anymore because of the war, the Baltic states did not suffer that much. So the whole infrastructure was still intact. And later on, you also have this image of the Baltic republics as Soviet West. So something that in a way is ours because it's Soviet, but it's completely different. It's basically like the West. And so you have all these artists and also tourists who would really enjoy to travel to the Baltic Soviet republics in order to get a kind of West-like feeling. Quite a lot of these imaginaries that were popular among the Soviet population about the West, in fact, were created in the Baltic, in the Baltic states, in the Baltic republics. And if you look at films, Soviet films, every film that was situated in the so-called West was shot, of course, in the Soviet West, right?
Right.
In Riga or Tallinn. You have the famous stories of the famous story of the Soviet adaptation of the Sherlock Holmes detective stories, where the famous London Baker Street starts in Riga and ends in Tallinn, right? So this is really one of the most exciting examples of how Soviet film directors recreated the West.
Fascinating. And finally, what was the role of the Baltic states in the dissolution of the Soviet Union?
This is a much debated question. There are historians of the perestroika period that would re really marginalize the meaning of nationalism in the Baltic states as a factor in the demise of the Soviet Union, whereas the historians in the three Baltic states would rather overemphasize the role of Baltic nationalism. I think, as always, I mean, the truth is somewhere in between, but we have to take into account that the whole Baltic issue was something that was quite aggressively used for Baltic PR in the West. The whole story of this Baltic chain in August 89, when you have these almost 2 million of Baltic citizens joining hands from Tallinn to Vilnius, this
Sure.
was, of course, the major event that really brought the Baltic issue on the agenda of politicians worldwide,
And I
even though
love
we
it.
have
My
quite a lot of numbers who were not, quite a lot of people, of members of the political leaderships at that time, who desperately tried not to overemphasize the Baltic issue because they needed Gorbachev to stay in power, especially Helmut Kohl, because German reunification without Gorbachev would not have been possible, right?
Right.
So this was the difficult situation for the Baltic leaders at that time. They perfectly knew that they cannot help. They cannot expect open help from Western Germany at that time, neither from Finland, right? Because Finland had this special relationship to Moscow. But on the other hand, in the case of Germany, it was of course civil society that started to help the Balts in these years. All these people who had still this family relationship with Baltic Germans, they tried to collect money. They sent some I don't know, items people would use, would need in the Baltic states to them. So this was also a very important way of how to mobilize this solidarity community in the West.
Okay, well, thank you for coming on and discussing the Russian factor in Baltic history in the 18th and 19th century, Dr. Bergman. And
Thank you for having me.
all right, well, have a good day. Nagamist.
Negamist, Yataka. Thank you.
Edaiga. And it was nice for Professor Bergman not to correct me as we discussed the Baltic factor in the 19th and 20th centuries, not the 18th and 19th, as I stated. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. When we meet next, we will discuss the Forrest brothers in Estonia. We will be extremely fortunate to have a special guest with us to discuss this tumultuous period in Estonia, which, as one might say, is in his blood. We will have with us General Martin Herem, the overall commander of the Estonian Defense Forces. I am certainly looking forward to our conversation. Signing out, this is William Parsley, and the music for today's episode is Tchaikovsky's Souvenir de Hopsul, Opus 2. Nagamist.